Part 3. The Final Phase in the Western Counter Strategy. 25. The Final Phase. The contention of this book has been that, during the past two decades, the Communist bloc has substantially achieved the objectives of the first two phases of its long-range policy. The individual Communist regimes have been consolidated. The bloc Communist parties, with the help of the security services, have built up their active forces within revitalized national and international front organizations, especially those concerned with trade unions, intellectuals, and young people. The importance of this drive is demonstrated by the appointment of Shelepin as head of the Soviet Trade Union Organization from 1967 to 1975. The credibility abroad of dissidents as a serious internal political factor in the communist world has been established. A degree of accommodation with organized religion has been achieved. A nexus of interparty relationships, transcending the formal structure of Comecon and the Warsaw Pact, has been built up. In consequence, the communist strategists are now poised to enter into the final, offensive phase of the long-range policy, entailing a joint struggle for the complete triumph of communism. Given the multiplicity of parties in power, the close links between them, and the opportunities they have had to broaden their bases and build up experienced cadres, the communist strategists are equipped, in pursuing their policy, to engage in maneuvers and stratagems beyond the imagination of Marx or the practical reach of Lenin and unthinkable to Stalin. Among such previously unthinkable stratagems are the introduction of false liberalization in Eastern Europe and, probably, in the Soviet Union and the exhibition of spurious independence on the part of the regimes in Romania, Czechoslovakia, and Poland. Western misinterpretation of events in Poland. Because the West has failed either to understand communist strategy and disinformation or to appreciate the commitment to it of the resources of the bloc security and intelligence services and their high-level agents of political influence. The appearance of solidarity in Poland has been accepted as a spontaneous occurrence comparable with the Hungarian Revolt of 1956 and as portending the demise of communism in Poland. The fact that the Italian, French, and Spanish Communist parties all took up pro-solidarity positions gives grounds for suspecting the validity of this interpretation. Western misreading of events led to predictions of Soviet intervention in Poland in 1981, which turned out to be unjustified. It may lead to more serious errors in the future. A new analysis. There are strong indications that the Polish version of democratization, based in part on the Czechoslovak model, was prepared and controlled from the outset within the framework of bloc policy and strategy. For 20 years, the Polish Communist Party had been working on the construction of a mature socialist society in which the party and its mass organizations would play a more active and effective political role. In 1963, the party's ideological commission was set up. In 1973, new means of coordinating the activities of youth organizations were established. In 1976, a new law was adopted on the leading role of the party in constructing communism and on the party's interaction with the peasant and democratic parties. In the same year, all youth organizations, including those of the army, were merged into one union of socialist Polish youth. Party membership increased from 1 million in 1960 to 3 million in 1980. In the same period, Polish trade unions increased their membership from 5 to 13 million. The Union of Socialist Polish Youth had 2 million members in 1980. By the end of that year, 85% of the Army's officer corps were party members. All Poles of Jewish origin had been eliminated from the Army. Throughout the 20-year period, Polish leaders have been fully involved in the coordinating mechanisms of the bloc, such as Kornikon and the Warsaw Pact, as well as in bilateral meetings with other communist parties. The Polish Security Service took part in the conference in Moscow in 1959 of bloc security services at which their new political role was discussed and means of coordination were improved. Poland was among the countries visited by Mironov, the originator of this new political role, when he was head of the CPSU's administrative department. Developments in the 1970s. Significantly, two of the key figures in recent Polish events, the so-called renewal, took up important positions soon after the Prague Spring in 1968. Jaruzelski became Minister of Defense, and Kania became head of the Polish Communist Party's Administrative Department, with responsibility for the affairs of the Polish Security Service. In 1971, Jarek took over from Gomułka, and the future leader of Solidarity, Walesa, began his political activity. Jarek and members of other important departments, including Kama's Administrative Department, consulted with their Soviet counterparts in Moscow. In the same year, the Polish and Czech leaders had several meetings. In 1973, an agreement on ideological cooperation was signed between the two parties. In 1977, a delegation led by Jirek signed an agreement on the further strengthening of cooperation between them. Jirek also took part in Crimean summit meetings in the 1970s at which strategic questions were discussed. In the course of the 1970s, Kania was promoted to be Minister of the Interior and a member of the Politburo with responsibility for supervising the army and the security police. He also acted as the government's principal link with the politically active Catholic Church. After the renewal had begun, Kania was further promoted to be leader of the party. Two other security chiefs were also promoted, Moxer to membership in the Politburo and Kowalczyk to be deputy premier. These promotions aren't the clearest indication of the involvement of Kania in the security services and the preparation of the Polish renewal. Final preparations for the renewal. There was intensive consultation between Polish and Soviet leaders and party officials in the 2 years preceding the renewal. Among the more significant items, apart from Comic-Con and Warsaw Pact meetings, were the appointment of a new Soviet ambassador to Poland in 1978, Aristov, a senior party official from Leningrad. A conference in Moscow of bloc officials, including Poles, on organizational matters and mass organizations, Jaruzelski's visit to Moscow in 1978. The meeting of Jaruzelski and the commander-in-chief of the Warsaw Pact forces in 1979. Two meetings in 1978 and 1979 between Soviet and Polish party officials responsible for strategy and coordination of the communist movement, at which there were discussions on international and ideological questions, visits to Moscow by Kruczek, the chairman of the Polish Trade Union Organization, and by Szydliak, head of the Polish-Soviet Friendship Society, who discussed the strengthening of Soviet-Polish cooperation with his Soviet counterpart, Shidakov. This last visit is particularly interesting, since between February and August 1980, just before the renewal, Szydliak was head of the Polish trade unions. In 1979, Jirek had two meetings with Brezhnev and separate meetings with the Czechoslovak, East German, West German, and French Communist Party leaders. At the meeting with Brezhnev in the Crimea in August 1979, the discussion focused on favorable new conditions for joint action in Europe. In February 1980, a Soviet publication referred to the strengthening of fraternal relations between the two countries resulting from agreements reached at their meetings. A Polish party delegation attended a 29-party conference in Hungary in December 1979 that discussed relations between communists and social democrats and perspectives for European security. Suslov, the late leading Soviet ideologist and strategist, headed the Soviet delegation to the Polish Party Congress in February 1980. At the Congress, Jirek attacked NATO and the deployment of nuclear missiles in Western Europe and offered to act as host to an East-West disarmament conference in Warsaw. In May 1980, Brezhnev, Gromyko, and other senior Soviet officials attended a conference of bloc leaders in Warsaw. In his introductory speech, Jirek said that the conference would open new prospects for peace and security in Europe and the world. His speech was the only part of the proceedings to be published. There were frequent consultations between Polish party officials responsible for the press, TV, and radio with their Soviet colleagues, suggesting preparation of the Soviet and Polish media for a forthcoming important event. Brezhnev awarded honors to Jirek and Jaruzelski in 1978, and Jirek honored Ruzikov, head of the CPCU's Department for Bloc Affairs, in February 1980. The awards can be seen as recognition of the contributions made to the preparation of the renewal by some of its key figures. It may also be surmised that Jirek's departure from the scene was envisaged at this stage. He doubtless had good reason for saying, shortly after his dismissal, that proper appraisal of the Polish developments in the 1970s could only be made from a certain distance in time. All of the foregoing evidence points to the conclusion that a major development in Poland, the renewal, was planned thoroughly and well in advance by the Polish Communist Party in cooperation with its communist allies and with a view to furthering the communist strategy for Europe. The conclusion is further supported by the evidence of the Polish Communist Party's involvement in the formation and functioning of Solidarity. The Polish Communist Party within Solidarity. Kania himself revealed that there were 1 million Communist Party members in Solidarity. 42 out of the 200 members of the party's Central Committee in 1981 were Solidarity members. Bogdan Lis, Walesa's deputy, was a central committee member. Zofia Gryzb, another Solidarity leader, was a member of the Politburo. These leaders were not expelled from the party for their membership in Solidarity. On the contrary, Solidarity recognized the leading role of the party, and the party recognized Solidarity's existence. Kania and Moxer even made statements in favor of it. Solidarity enjoyed access to the state-controlled media. Obstacles were not placed in the way of Walesa's extensive foreign travels. Indeed, the Polish ambassador to Japan, who defected after the introduction of martial law, assisted in arranging Walesa's contacts with Japanese trade unions. Stripping away the disinformation as before, it becomes clear that the changes in the leadership of the Polish party from Jarek to Kania to Jaruzelski were not the outcome of power struggles between factions and the leadership, but reflections of different stages in the renewal process, in the planning of which all of the leaders were equally involved. The visits of Kania and other Polish leaders to Moscow and the visits of Suslov and Gromyko to Poland in April and July 1981 were part of the process of high-level coordination and readjustment of an agreed-upon strategic plan, not evidence of Soviet coercion being exercised over the Polish leaders. Soviet military and naval maneuvers in the vicinity while the renewal was being introduced would have been planned and agreed in advance with the Polish and East German governments as a warning to the Polish and East German peoples that genuine anti-communist feeling would not be allowed to get out of hand. Motives for the creation of Solidarity. As with the Prague Spring of 1968, the motives for the Polish renewal were a combination of the internal and external. Internally, it was designed to broaden the political base of the Communist Party and the trade unions and to convert the narrow elitist dictatorship of the party into a Leninist dictatorship of the whole working class that would revitalize the Polish political and economic system. The renewal followed the lines of Lenin's speech to the Comintern Congress in July 1921. "Our only strategy at present," said Lenin, "is to become stronger and therefore wiser, more reasonable, more opportunistic. The more opportunistic, the sooner will you assemble again the masses around you. When we have won over the masses by our reasonable approach, we shall then apply offensive tactics in the strictest sense of the word." Polish trade unions before the renewal were suffering from the stigma of party control. To have attempted to apply Leninist principles by creating a new trade union organization through governmental action would have failed to remove that stigma. The new organization had to appear to have been set up from below. Its independence had to be established by carefully calculated and controlled confrontation with the government. The origin of the Solidarity movement in a shipyard bearing Lenin's name, the singing of the Internationale, the use of the old slogan, "Workers of the World, Unite," by Solidarity members, and the constant presence of Lenin's portrait are all consistent with concealed party guidance of the organization. Without that guidance and help, the discipline of Solidarity and its record of successful negotiation with the Polish government would have been impossible. The party's concealed influence in the Polish Catholic Church ensured that the church would act as a force for moderation and compromise between Solidarity and the government. Externally, the strategic objectives behind the creation of Solidarity resemble those behind the Prague Spring. In brief, they were to deceive Western governments, politicians, and public opinion generally as to the real nature of contemporary communism in Poland in accordance with the weakness and evolution pattern of disinformation. More specifically, the intention was to use Solidarity to promote united action with free trade unions, social democrats, Catholics, and other religious groups to further the aims of communist strategy in the advanced countries, and to a lesser extent in the Third World. The name Solidarity is itself symbolic of this intention, which was made plain by Walesa's state-sponsored visits to trade unions in France, Italy, and Japan, and to the Holy See. Solidarity's effort to strengthen its international ties was part of a wider effort by the international communist movement to press forward with its strategy. In February 1981, Brezhnev spoke about the new, favorable conditions for unity of action in the World Trade Union movement. The Communist World Federation of Trade Unions and regional European, Latin American, and Arab trade union bodies stepped up their campaigns against monopolies and in favor of disarmament. Meetings in Moscow in October 1980 and Berlin in March 1981 discussed working-class solidarity and new forms of cooperation with trade unions of differing political orientation. A Soviet trade union delegation visited Italy for talks with three major Italian trade union federations. The influence of Solidarity was felt throughout the labor movement, even in the United States, where the left showed interest in Solidarity's experience. The communist intention was, and will remain, to exploit this influence for strategic ends. The creation of Solidarity in the initial period of its activity as a trade union may be regarded as the experimental first phase of the Polish renewal. The appointment of Jaruzelski, the imposition of martial law, and the suspension of Solidarity represent the second phase, intended to bring the movement under firm control and to provide a period of political consolidation. In the third phase, it may be expected that a coalition government will be formed, comprising representatives of the Communist Party, of a revived Solidarity movement, and of the Church. A few so-called liberals might also be included. A new-style government of this sort in Eastern Europe would be well-equipped to promote communist strategy by campaigning for disarmament, for nuclear-free zones in Europe, perhaps for a revival of the Rapacki Plan, for the simultaneous dissolution of NATO and the Warsaw Pact, and ultimately for the establishment of a neutral, socialist Europe. The revival of other elements of communist strategy for Europe, Eurocommunism and CSC negotiations, for example, would be timed to coincide with the emergence of such a government. Intensified solidarity campaigns between East and West European trade unions and peace movements could be expected. Preparations are, in fact, already in train. In October 1980, a new all-European structure for youth organizations was set up at a conference of 500 national youth organizations held in Budapest. A meeting of the World Parliament was held in Sofia in September 1980, in which leading communist authorities on United Action took part. The Soviet and East European Committee for European Security was reactivated. A meeting of parliamentarians from communist states was held in Moscow in March 1981, at which Shidakov was much in evidence. There are increasing signs of preparation for a communist initiative on Germany, the key to progress toward a neutral, socialist Europe. Among these were the meeting between Brezhnev and the East German leader, Honecker, in the Crimea in 1980, at which a European conference on disarmament was discussed. Similar discussions took place between the Soviet and West German peace committees in February 1980. A specialist on Germany, Zyrek, was appointed Polish foreign minister. Another specialist on Germany, Kwiatkowski, was chosen late in 1981 to be chief negotiator for the Geneva nuclear arms reduction talks. 1. Winkelmann, former head of the International Department of the East German Communist Party, was appointed ambassador to the Soviet Union in March 1981. Fallon, a senior CPSU official and former ambassador to West Germany, was appointed deputy head of the USSR West Germany Society, and Zamyatin, a CPSU Central Committee official, was appointed head of the section of Soviet parliamentarians in contact with West Germany. A revived solidarity movement could be expected to extend its influence in Latin America, drawing together social democrats, Catholics, and progressives against military dictatorships. Here again, there are signs of preparation. There was a meeting of Soviet and Latin American trade union leaders in Moscow in April 1981, and there were other, WFTU-sponsored, preparatory meetings for a World Congress of Trade Unions of Different Orientation in Cuba. The threat to the West from the Polish renewal. A coalition government in Poland would in fact be totalitarianism under a new, deceptive, and more dangerous guise. Accepted as the spontaneous emergence of a new form of multi-party, semi-democratic regime, it would serve to undermine resistance to communism inside and outside the communist bloc. The need for massive defense expenditure would increasingly be questioned in the West. New possibilities would arise for splitting Western Europe away from the United States, of neutralizing Germany, and destroying NATO. With North American influence and Latin America also undermined, the stage would be set for achieving actual revolutionary changes in the Western world through spurious changes in the communist system. If in a reasonable time, liberalization can be successfully achieved in Poland and elsewhere, it will serve to revitalize the communist regimes concerned. The activities of the false opposition will further confuse and undermine the genuine opposition in the communist world. Externally, the role of dissidents will be to persuade the West that the liberalization is spontaneous and not controlled. Liberalization will create conditions for establishing solidarity between trade unions and intellectuals in the communist and non-communist worlds. In time, such alliances will generate new forms of pressure against Western militarism, racism, and military-industrial complexes, and in favor of disarmament and the kind of structural changes in the West predicted in Sakharov's writings. If liberalization is successful and accepted by the West as genuine, it may well be followed by the apparent withdrawal of one or more communist countries from the Warsaw Pact to serve as the model of a neutral, socialist state for the whole of Europe to follow. Some dissidents are already speaking in these terms. Yugoslavia may be expected to play a conspicuous role in the new scenario. A display of Sino-Soviet rivalry for influence in Europe may be expected on the lines of the struggle for hegemony already being witnessed in Southeast Asia. Its purpose would be to assist in the creation of new, false alignments between communist and non-communist powers, and to break up the existing NATO structure and replace it with a system of European collective security entailing the ultimate withdrawal of the American military presence from Western Europe and the growth of communist influence there. It is through flexible maneuvers such as these that the ruling communist parties, in contrast with the damaging rigidities of their performances during the Stalinist period, will provide the international communist movement with the kind of strategic backing Togliatti had in mind. The recent travels of Chairman Hua to Yugoslavia and Romania and the closer ties between the French and Italian communist parties and the Chinese are portents of things to come. In fact, using the new methodology, more and more signs can be detected that the onset of the final phase of communist long-range policy is imminent. The arrest and exile of Sakharov, the occupation of Afghanistan, developments in Poland, and the Iraqi attack on Iran in the autumn of 1980 are among the pointers. The last two are of special strategic importance. The developments in Poland look like a major move toward the final phase of communist strategy for Europe. The Iraqi attack on Iran looks like a concerted effort by radical Arab states, each of which is in a united front relationship with the Soviet Union against imperialism, to use dual tactics, hostilities by Iraq, assistance by Syria and Libya, with the single overall objective of bringing Iran into an anti-Western alliance with them. The object of the alliance would be to gain control over a strategically vital area of the Middle East. Its success could but serve the strategic interests of the communist bloc. Despite Saddam Hussein's alleged purges of communists in Iraq and the moderation in his attitude toward the United States, he is continuing to receive arms supplies from communist sources, as are his Iranian opponents. Certainly, the next 5 years will be a period of intensive struggle. It will be marked by a major coordinated communist offensive intended to exploit the success of the strategic disinformation program over the past 20 years and to take advantage of the crisis and mistakes it has engendered in Western policies toward the communist bloc. The overall aim will be to bring about a major and irreversible shift in the balance of world power in favor of the bloc as a preliminary to the final ideological objective of establishing a worldwide federation of communist states. There are a number of strategic options at the disposal of the communist strategists that can be used in various combinations to achieve their ultimate objectives. It would be impossible to list them all, but five likely interconnected options are as follows. A closer alignment of an independent socialist Europe with the Soviet bloc and a parallel alignment of the United States with China. Japan, depending on whether it remains conservative or moves towards socialism, might join either combination. A joint drive by the Soviet bloc and a socialist Europe to seek allies in the Third World against the United States and China. In the military field, an intensive effort to achieve U.S. nuclear disarmament. In the ideological and political field, East-West convergence on communist terms. The creation of a world federation of communist states. In each of these, the scissors strategy will play its part. Probably, as the final stroke, the scissors blades will close. The element of apparent duality in Soviet and Chinese policies will disappear. The hitherto concealed coordination between them will become visible and predominant. The Soviets and the Chinese will be officially reconciled. Thus, the scissors strategy will develop logically into the strategy of one clenched fist to provide the foundation and driving force of a world communist federation. The suggested European option would be promoted by a revival of controlled democratization on the Czechoslovak pattern in Eastern Europe, including probably Czechoslovakia and the Soviet Union. The intensification of hardline policies and methods in the Soviet Union, exemplified by Sakharov's arrest and the occupation of Afghanistan, presages a switch to democratization following, perhaps, Brezhnev's departure from the political scene. The following observations were made prior to Brezhnev's death. They are followed by comments on developments subsequent to that event, beginning on page 347. Ed. Brezhnev's successor may well appear to be a kind of Soviet Dubček. The succession will be important only in a presentational sense. The reality of collective leadership and the leaders' common commitment to the long-range policy will continue unaffected. Conceivably, an announcement will be made to the effect that the economic and political foundations of communism in the Soviet Union have been laid and that democratization is therefore possible. This would provide the framework for the introduction of a new set of reforms. The Brezhnev regime and its neo-Stalinistic actions against dissidents and in Afghanistan would be condemned as Novotny's regime was condemned in 1968. In the economic field, reforms might be expected to bring Soviet practice more into line with Yugoslav, or even, seemingly, with Western socialist models. Some economic ministries might be dissolved. Control would be more decentralized. Individual self-managing firms might be created from existing plants and factories. Material incentives would be increased. The independent role of technocrats, workers' councils, and trade unions would be enhanced. The party's control over the economy would be apparently diminished. Such reforms would be based on Soviet experience in the 1920s and 1960s, as well as on Yugoslav experience. The party would be less conspicuous, but would continue to control the economy from behind the scenes as before. The picture being deliberately painted now of stagnation and deficiencies in the Soviet economy should be seen as part of the preparation for deceptive innovations. It is intended to give the innovations greater impact on the West when they are introduced. Political liberalization and democratization would follow the general lines of the Czechoslovak rehearsal in 1968. This rehearsal might well have been the kind of political experiment Mironov had in mind as early as 1960. The liberalization would be spectacular and impressive. Formal pronouncements might be made about a reduction in the Communist Party's role. Its monopoly would be apparently curtailed. An ostensible separation of powers between the legislative, the executive, and the judiciary might be introduced. The Supreme Soviet would be given greater apparent power and the president and deputies greater apparent independence. The posts of president of the Soviet Union and first secretary of the party might well be separated. The KGB would be reformed. Dissidents at home would be amnestied. Those in exile abroad would be allowed to return, and some would take up positions of leadership in government. Sakharov might be included in some capacity in the government or allowed to teach abroad. The creative arts and cultural and scientific organizations, such as the Writers' Unions and Academy of Sciences, would become apparently more independent, as would the trade unions. Political clubs would be open to non-members of the Communist Party. Leading dissidents might form one or more alternative political parties. Censorship would be relaxed. Controversial books, plays, films, and art would be published, performed, and exhibited. Many prominent Soviet performing artists now abroad would return to the Soviet Union and resume their professional careers. Constitutional amendments would be adopted to guarantee fulfillment of the provisions of the Helsinki agreements and a semblance of compliance would be maintained. There would be greater freedom for Soviet citizens to travel. Western and United Nations observers would be invited to the Soviet Union to witness the reforms in action. But, as in the Czechoslovak case, the liberalization would be calculated and deceptive in that it would be introduced from above. It would be carried out by the party through its cells and individual members in government, the Supreme Soviet, the courts, and the electoral machinery, and by the KGB through its agents among the intellectuals and scientists. It would be the culmination of Shilpin's plans. It would contribute to the stabilization of the regime at home and to the achievement of its goals abroad. The arrest of Sakharov in January 1980 raises the question of why the KGB, which was so successful in the past in protecting state secrets and suppressing opposition while concealing the misdemeanors of the regime, is so ineffective now. Why in particular did it allow Western access to Sakharov, and why were his arrest and internal exile so gratuitously publicized? The most likely answer is that his arrest and the harassment of other dissidents is intended to make a future amnesty more credible and convincing. In that case, the dissident movement is now being prepared for the most important aspect of its strategic role, which will be to persuade the West of the authenticity of Soviet liberalization when it comes. Further high-level defectors, or official émigrés, may well make their appearance in the West before the switch in policy occurs. The prediction on Soviet compliance with the Helsinki agreements is based on the fact that it was the Warsaw Pact countries and the Soviet agent Timo who initiated and pressed for the CSC process. Since the Soviets signed the CSC agreements, they may be expected at some stage, at least, to go through the motions of complying with them. Their present ostentatious non-compliance, noted at the follow-up conferences in Belgrade and Madrid, is intended to heighten the effect of their switch to apparent compliance in the final phase of policy. Liberalization in Eastern Europe would probably involve the return to power in Czechoslovakia of Dubček and his associates. If it should be extended to East Germany, demolition of the Berlin Wall might even be contemplated. Western acceptance of the new liberalization as genuine would create favorable conditions for the fulfillment of communist strategy for the United States, Western Europe, and even, perhaps, Japan. The Prague Spring was accepted by the West, and not only by the left, as the spontaneous and genuine evolution of a communist regime into a form of democratic, humanistic socialism, despite the fact that basically the regime, the structure of the party, and its objectives remain the same. Its impact has already been described. A broader scale liberalization in the Soviet Union and elsewhere would have an even more profound effect. Eurocommunism could be revived. The pressure for united fronts between communist and socialist parties and trade unions at national and international level would be intensified. This time, the socialists might finally fall into the trap. United front governments under strong communist influence might well come to power in France, Italy, and possibly other countries. Elsewhere, the fortunes and influence of communist parties would be much revived. The bulk of Europe might well turn to left-wing socialism, leaving only a few pockets of conservative resistance. Pressure could well grow for a solution of the German problem, in which some form of confederation between East and West Germany would be combined with neutralization of the whole and a treaty of friendship with the Soviet Union. France and Italy, under united front governments, would throw in their lot with Germany and the Soviet Union. Britain would be confronted with a choice between a neutral Europe and the United States. NATO could hardly survive this process. The Czechoslovaks, in contrast with their performance in 1968, might well take the initiative, along with the Romanians and Yugoslavs, in proposing in the CSC context. The dissolution of the Warsaw Pact in return for the dissolution of NATO. The disappearance of the Warsaw Pact would have little effect on the coordination of the communist bloc, but the dissolution of NATO could well mean the departure of American forces from the European continent and a closer European alignment with a liberalized Soviet bloc. Perhaps in the longer run, a similar process might affect the relationship between the United States and Japan, leading to abrogation of the security pact between them. The EEC on present lines, even if enlarged, would not be a barrier to the neutralization of Europe and the withdrawal of American troops. It might even accelerate the process. The acceptance of the EEC by Eurocommunist parties in the 1970s, following a period of opposition in the 1960s, suggests that this view is shared by the communist strategists. The efforts by the Yugoslavs and Romanians to create stronger links with the EEC should be seen not as inimical to Soviet interests, but as the first steps in laying the foundation for a merger between the EEC and Comecon. The European Parliament might become an all-European socialist parliament with representation from the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals would turn out to be a neutral, socialist Europe. The United States, betrayed by her former European allies, would tend to withdraw into Fortress America or, with the few remaining conservative countries, including perhaps Japan, would seek an alliance with China as the only counterweight to Soviet power. The greater the fear of a Soviet socialist European coalition, the stronger the argument for playing the China card on the false assumption that China is a true enemy of the Soviet Union. Liberalization in Eastern Europe on the scale suggested could have a social and political impact on the United States itself, especially if it coincided with a severe economic depression. The communist strategists are on the lookout for such an opportunity. Soviet and other communist economists keep a careful watch on the American economic situation. Since the adoption of the long-range policy, an Institute of World Economy and International Relations, originally under Arzamanian and now under Inno Zimsev, has been analyzing and forecasting for the Central Committee the performance of the non-communist, and especially the American, economic system. Inno Zimsev is a frequent visitor to the United States and was a member of a Soviet delegation received by the U.S. Congress in January 1978. The communist bloc will not repeat its error in failing to exploit a slump as it did in 1929-32. At that time, the Soviet Union was weak politically and economically. Next time, the situation would be different. Politically, the bloc would be better poised to exploit economic depression as proof of the failure of the capitalist system. Information from communist sources that the bloc is short of oil and grain should be treated with particular reserve. since it could well be intended to conceal preparation for the final phase of the policy and to induce the West to underestimate the potency of the bloc's economic weapons. The bloc would certainly have an interest in secretly building up reserves of oil and grain that could be used for political purposes in a time of crisis to support newly established pro-communist governments in Europe or elsewhere. It is worth noting that the scale of Soviet oil exports to India is already producing political dividends for the Soviet Union. Sino-Soviet relations. Liberalization in the Soviet Union could well be accompanied by a deepening of the Sino-Soviet split. This might include a rupture in trade and diplomatic relations, an increase in spectacular frontier incidents, and perhaps deeper incursions into one another's territory on the lines of the Chinese invasion of Vietnam in 1979. An invasion that could well have been intended as a rehearsal for a future Sino-Soviet operation. A deepening of the split would sharpen the scissors strategy. It would encourage an even closer alignment with China of the United States and any other surviving conservative nations against a Soviet socialist European coalition. Military cooperation would be included in this alignment, and China might go so far as to offer bases in return for help in building up her military potential. In this connection, the agreements on bases between the United States and Somalia and Egypt may be a portent. A breach in diplomatic relations between the Soviet Union and China might complicate but would not interrupt the process of policy coordination between them. They have now had 20 years in which to build up experience and mutual confidence in handling a bogus split. The existing Sino-Soviet bilateral links, political, diplomatic, and economic, could have been used for the purpose of coordinating Sino-Soviet disinformation activity connected with the split. Interruption of those channels might be a handicap, but there has been time in which to prepare alternative solutions to the problem of coordination. The breach in Soviet-Albanian diplomatic relations in 1960 was not followed by a breach in relations between Albania and all the other East European communist states. Following this precedent, Romania and Yugoslavia at least might be expected to maintain their representation in Peking if the Soviets were to withdraw or be thrown out. To some extent, Sino-Soviet coordination could be carried on through Romanian and Yugoslav intermediaries. Another possibility is that direct, secret communications links exist between the Soviet Union and China that are not accessible to the West. In addition, there is the possible existence of a secret bloc headquarters staffed by senior representatives of the major communist states, to which allusion has been made above. The Third World. An alignment of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe with a socialist Western Europe would exert a powerful influence over Third World socialist parties and trade unions. Some of the remaining conservative Third World countries would be strongly drawn toward a socialist orientation. Resistance to communism from the Socialist International would be replaced by a combined communist-socialist drive for Third World influence, backed by economic aid. It would have far-reaching consequences, especially if U.S. aid should be curtailed in response to a severe depression. Soviet oil and grain could be used to good effect. In his article on Nicaragua, Arismendi, the leading Latin American communist strategist, envisaged international solidarity between socialists and communists in support of the national liberation. Struggle in Latin America. Point to Cuba, which might follow the Soviet example of liberalization. The 1980 Cuban immigration might be part of the preparation for such a move, would play an active part in the liberation struggle. Those leaders of the non-aligned movement who had close relations with communist countries would try to involve the rest of the non-aligned movement in concerted actions with communists and social democrats to promote the joint aims of procuring the disarmament of the United States and the reduction of its role as a world power, of isolating Israel, South Africa, and Chile, and of helping liberation movements in Latin America, Southern Africa, and the Middle East, especially the PLO. 3A variety of forums, the UN, the OAU, and the Brandt Commission on the North-South Problem, would be used for exerting political and economic pressure, including, if possible, the denial of oil. In apparent competition with the Soviet Union, China would step up its Third World activity. The United States could be tempted to encourage the growth and influence of China and her associates, such as Egypt, Somalia, and the Sudan, as a barrier to Soviet expansion. American support for China would greatly improve her openings for maneuver and for making false alliances with Thailand and Islamic countries, such as Pakistan, Iran, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and other conservative Arab states. It would also open doors for Chinese penetration of Latin America. The Soviet occupation of Afghanistan was used by the Chinese to improve their position in Pakistan. Following this pattern, more Soviet and Chinese interference could be expected in the affairs of neighbor states. Sino-Soviet rivalry did not impede the communist victory in Vietnam. It would not impede their Third World penetration. If the Third World were to be divided into pro-Soviet and pro-Chinese camps, it would be at the expense of the interests of the United States and any other surviving conservative Western nations. The final outcome of support for Chinese influence in the Third World would be the emergence of additional regimes there that would be hostile to the West. Disarmament. A Soviet Socialist European coalition, acting in concert with the non-aligned movement in the United Nations, would create favorable conditions for communist strategy on disarmament. The American military-industrial complex would come under heavy fire. Liberalization in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe would provide additional stimulus to disarmament. A massive U.S. defense budget might be found no longer justified. The argument for accommodation would be strengthened. Even China might throw in its weight in favor of a Soviet socialist line on arms control and disarmament. Convergence. After successful use of the scissors strategy in the early stages of the final phase of policy to assist communist strategy in Europe and the Third World and over disarmament, a Sino-Soviet reconciliation could be expected. It is contemplated and implied by the long-range policy and by strategic disinformation on the split. The communist bloc, with its recent accretions in Africa and Southeast Asia, is already strong. European-backed Soviet influence and American-backed Chinese influence could lead to new Third World acquisitions at an accelerating pace. Before long, the communist strategists might be persuaded that the balance had swung irreversibly in their favor. In that event, they might well decide on a Sino-Soviet reconciliation. The scissors strategy would give way to the strategy of one clenched fist. At that point, the shift in the political and military balance would be plain for all to see. Convergence would not be between two equal parties, but would be on terms dictated by the communist bloc. The argument for accommodation with the overwhelming strength of communism would be virtually unanswerable. Pressures would build up for changes in the American political and economic system on the lines indicated in Sakharov's treatise. Traditional conservatives would be isolated and driven toward extremism. They might become the victims of a new McCarthyism of the left. The Soviet dissidents who are now extolled as heroes of the resistance to Soviet communism would play an active part in arguing for convergence. Their present supporters would be confronted with a choice of forsaking their idols or acknowledging the legitimacy of the new Soviet regime. The Worldwide Communist Federation. Integration of the communist bloc would follow the lines envisaged by Lenin when the Third Communist International was founded. That is to say, the Soviet Union and China would not absorb one another or other communist states. All the countries of the European and Asiatic communist zones, together with new communist states in Europe and the Third World, would join a supranational economic and political communist federation. Soviet Albanian, Soviet Yugoslav, and Soviet Romanian disputes and differences would be resolved in the wake, or possibly in advance of, Sino-Soviet reconciliation. The political, economic, military, diplomatic, and ideological cooperation of between all the communist states, at present partially concealed, would become clearly visible. There might even be public acknowledgement that the splits and disputes were long-term disinformation operations that had successfully deceived the imperialist powers. The effect on Western morale can be imagined. In the new worldwide communist federation, the present different brands of communism would disappear to be replaced by a uniform, rigorous brand of Leninism. The process would be painful. Concessions made in the name of economic and political reform would be withdrawn. Religious and intellectual dissent would be suppressed. Nationalism and all other forms of genuine opposition would be crushed. Those who had taken advantage of détente to establish friendly Western contacts would be rebuked or persecuted like those Soviet officers who worked with the Allies during the Second World War. In new communist states, for example, in France, Italy, in the Third World, the alienated classes would be re-educated. Show trials of imperialist agents would be staged. Action would be taken against nationalist and social democratic leaders, party activists, former civil servants, officers, and priests. The last vestiges of private enterprise and ownership would be obliterated. Nationalization of industry, finance, and agriculture would be completed. In fact, all the totalitarian features familiar from the early stages of the Soviet Revolution in the post-war Stalinist years in Eastern Europe might be expected to reappear, especially in those countries newly won for communism. Unchallenged and unchallengeable, a true communist monolith would dominate the world. Comments on the appointment of Andropov and on other developments following the death of Brezhnev. These predictions and analyses were made during Brezhnev's tenure in office in anticipation of his departure. Brezhnev's succession and other developments confirm, in essence, the validity of the author's views. For example, the expeditiousness of the appointment of Andropov as Brezhnev's successor confirmed one of the main theses of this book, namely, that the succession problem in the Soviet leadership has been resolved. The practical consideration of the long-term strategies has become the major stabilizing factor in this solution. The promotion of the former KGB chief, who was responsible for the preparation of the false liberalization strategy in the USSR, indicates that this factor was decisive in his selection and further points to the imminent advent of such liberalization in the near future. The rise of Andropov fits into a familiar pattern whereby the former security chief becomes the party leader in order to secure the important shift in the realization of the strategy. Kader, who introduced the so-called liberalization in Hungary, Hua Kuofeng, under whom China shifted to capitalist pragmatism, and Kania, who initiated the Polish renewal and recognized solidarity. All had been former security chiefs. This pattern reflects the crucial role of the security services in the liberalization of communist regimes. The appointment of Andropov also implies that Shelepin would have been the successor of Brezhnev because of his initiation of preparation for the liberalization in the USSR, except for the compromise by Stashinsky, who exposed Shelepin's role in the assassination of the emigre leader Bandera, and further, because of the exposure, by this author, of Shelepin's role in the strategic reorientation of the KGB. Another important factor in the selection of Andropov was his leadership role in the preparation for the Czechoslovakian liberalization in 1967-68 and the liberalization in Hungary, which took place when he was the head of the Central Committee's department responsible for relations with communist countries until mid-1967. Therefore, the timing of the release of the Solidarity leader and the news of the appointment of Andropov confirm another point in the book, that the liberalization will not be limited to the USSR, but will be expanded to Eastern Europe and particularly to Poland. The experiment with renewal in Poland will be repeated again. This time, however, it will be with full strategic initiatives and implications against Western Europe and NATO. The appointment of Andropov, the release of the Solidarity leader, in the invitation to the Pope to visit Poland in June 1983, made by the Polish government, all indicate that the communist strategists probably are planning the reemergence of Solidarity in the creation of a quasi-social democratic government in Poland, a coalition of the Communist Party, the trade unions, and the churches. And political and economic reforms in the USSR for 1984 and afterward. The coming offensive of the communist strategists will pursue the following objectives: the establishment of a model government for Western Europe, which will facilitate the inclusion of the so-called Euro-communist parties into government coalitions with socialists and the trade unions, the dissolution of NATO and the Warsaw Pacts, the neutralization of Western Europe, and the Finlandization of Western Europe in general, through the advocacy of European collective security, the provision of a broader basis and impetus for expansion of the anti-military movement by a more active involvement of Catholics and other believers in the West, thereby forcing the United States into a disadvantageous disarmament, influencing the 1984 United States presidential election in favor of candidates who are more likely to deal with the leaders of the liberalized regimes in the USSR and East Europe and are more inclined to sacrifice the U.S. military posture. The dialectic of this offensive consists of a calculated shift from the old, discredited Soviet practice to a new, liberalized model with a social democratic facade to realize the communist planners' strategy for establishing a united Europe. At the beginning, they introduced a variation of the 1968 Czechoslovakian democratization. At a later phase, they will shift to a variation of the Czechoslovakian takeover of 1948. Developments have accurately confirmed the prediction that the communist strategists would undertake the political initiative on disarmament, particularly against West Germany. The trip of Gromyko to Bonn, the invitation of social democratic opposition leaders to Moscow, and the statements of Andropov on missile concessions made to influence the West German elections are all clear indications of such a political initiative. As expected, the communist initiative revealed that its main target was the socialist parties. It also showed that there are elements in their leadership who are vulnerable to such an initiative, especially those in the West German Social Democratic Party who have anti-NATO and anti-US views, or who, like Brandt and Sweden's Social Democrat Palm, are ready to embrace Rapacki's idea of a nuclear-free zone in Central Europe. The initiative increased also the pressure on the US for concessions to the USSR. In the opinion of the author, however, the communist initiative has not yet reached its peak. How will the Western German Social Democrats respond when the communist regimes begin their liberalization by making concessions on human rights, such as easing immigration, granting amnesty for the dissidents, or removing the Berlin Wall? One can expect that Soviet agents of influence in Western Europe, drawing on these developments, will become active. It is more than likely that these cosmetic steps will be taken as genuine by the West and will trigger a reunification and neutralization of West Germany and further the collapse of NATO. The pressure on the United States for concessions on disarmament and accommodation with the Soviets will increase. During this period, there might be an extensive display of the fictional struggle for power in the Soviet leadership. One cannot exclude that at the next party congress or earlier, Andropov will be replaced by a younger leader with a more liberal image who will continue the so-called liberalization more intensively. Sino-Soviet developments. It is also necessary to comment on developments in Sino-Soviet relations and their actions. The sending by China of a high-level delegation to the funeral of President Brezhnev, headed by Foreign Minister Huang Hua, the conduct of talks between Huang Hua and Gromyko, and the unusual statement made by Huang Hua characterizing Brezhnev as an outstanding statesman of the Soviet Union all have some significance. Especially significant and contradictory was a reference to the loss of Brezhnev, a great statesman. This characterization ignores the fact that the worst hostilities with China, if one accepts the conventional point of view, took place under Brezhnev. Such a favorable assessment of Brezhnev seems accurate and sound. However, if one accepts Sino-Soviet hostilities as strategic disinformation, according to the analysis developed in this book, these developments add to and strengthen the validity of the author's argument that the Sino-Soviet split was a disinformation mask over their secret coordination for the realization of their common strategies. Because of the secret strategic Sino-Soviet cooperation, still according to this analysis, the primary objective for the Soviet move into Afghanistan, aside from achieving its Sovietization, was not to encircle China, but to force the United States and Pakistan into a close political and military cooperation with China. It is not inconceivable that the Soviets will make concessions on Afghanistan in order to gain new strategic advantages. Andropov's proposals about improving relations with China are not aimed at undermining China's relations with the United States, but at stimulating a revival of an American interest in closer relations with China, which are presently perceived as weakened after the departure of such strong proponents of United States-Chinese military cooperation as Brzezinski and others. Its main purpose is to facilitate the acquisition by China of American weaponry and military technology. The Soviet occupation of Afghanistan also may be designed to create more favorable conditions for China's penetration into Muslim countries, capitalizing on China's success with Pakistan. The recent trip of China's premier to Africa, which included visits to Egypt, Algeria, and Morocco, confirms another point in the book about the existing division of labor between the Soviet Union and China. It seems that the influencing of Muslim countries has been left to China by the Soviet strategists. As for China's role in the realization of communist strategy in Europe, the Sino-Soviet rivalry might be exploited by China's intervening in European politics under the pretext of resisting Soviet hegemony. In this case, the Chinese strategists might try to gain a Rapallo type of arrangement with some conservative governments of Western Europe. The attempted assassination of the Pope. It is also necessary to comment on the attempt to assassinate the Pope. The author is not naive about the attitude, involvement, and practice of political terrorism by the KGB. Earlier in the book, he expressed the view that the Soviet and other communist services were behind the political terrorism of the Red Brigade in Italy and terrorism in Western Germany. The question here, however, is not whether the Soviets control the Bulgarian services as they control other communist services, or whether the Soviets and Bulgarians are involved in terrorism in Western Europe, but whether the KGB and the Bulgarian services are involved in this particular attempted assassination. In order to make an assessment of the assassination attempt against the Pope, it is not enough to refer to Soviet control of the Bulgarian service. One must first examine the Soviet rationale for political assassinations, and then address the basic question, whether the Soviet strategists have a political interest and a real need to get involved in such an affair. The author does not share the view that the KGB and the Bulgarian service are involved in the assassination attempt against the Pope perpetrated by Agca, a Turkish gunman. This conclusion is based on the following reasons. 1. This assassination attempt does not fit into the rationale of assassinations as practiced by the KGB. According to the author's understanding, the Soviet government and the KGB would resort to a political assassination of a Western leader only under the following conditions. A. If a Western leader, who is a recruited Soviet agent, is threatened in office by a political rival. This is based on a statement made by Zenikov, a former KGB resident in Finland. He stated that if his agent, holding a high office, was threatened by an anti-communist social democrat during the elections, the latter would be poisoned by a trusted KGB agent. B. If a Western leader became a serious obstacle to communist strategy and to the strategic disinformation program, he would be quietly poisoned at a summit meeting during negotiations or while visiting a communist country, since détente provides such opportunities in abundance. The practical lesson here is that a Western leader who is involved in furthering an effective counter-strategy against the communists should not visit communist countries or take part in any summit meetings with their leaders. The technique for a poisoning was described in a statement made by a KGB general, Zeleznyakov, at an operational briefing devoted to an assassination proposal against Tito in 1953 in Moscow. Zeleznyakov stated that the major requirement for success is mere physical contact with the target, as the Soviet service has technical means, special poisons, to inflict mortal diseases without leaving traces of the poison, so that death will be attributed to natural causes. C. If the assassination of a leader provides the opportunity for a controlled Soviet agent to take over the position. According to Levinov, a KGB advisor in Czechoslovakia, this rationale was used by both the Soviet and the Czech services in the assassination of President Beneš, thus vacating a place for a communist leader, Gottwald. D. If a communist leader decided to eliminate his communist rival. It is a well-known fact that, based on this rationale, Stalin got rid of many of his rivals, including Trotsky in Mexico. According to the author, this rationale is not used any longer because of the cessation of the struggle for power in the Soviet party leadership. 2. In view of the arguments and reasoning made about Polish developments in this book, particularly those concerning solidarity as a product of mature socialism, it is clear that there is no motive for such an assassination of the Pope by the KGB and their communist partners. 3. The author regards as erroneous the perception that the KGB is a primitive and inefficient service that would resort to the use of the Bulgarian service to recruit a killer for hire, especially one who was guilty of murdering a progressive editor in Turkey and who had earlier escaped from prison and had somehow made a strange visit to Bulgaria. According to the author's understanding, the KGB is always apprehensive about using escapees, suspecting the possibility of their being police provocateurs. The KGB would not consider such a candidate, unknown to them and over whom they had no control, for an operation of such importance and sensitivity. 4. If the Soviet strategists had reason for such assassinations, they would not attempt to act through the Bulgarian service. More likely, the KGB would undertake such a mission through their trusted illegals or through opportunities available to the Polish service. It is well known that the Pope maintains a vast staff of secretaries and kitchen help, almost all consisting of Polish nationals. He further receives visitors from Poland. The Polish Security Service, through its anti-religious department, would study the relatives of people on the Pope's staff and would use them as hostages in the preparation of such an operation. It would be a quiet, secret operation. 5. The author is also of the opinion that the Italian services, which are seriously weakened by recent scandals and investigations, are too inexperienced to assess the strategic complexity and implications of such an operation. This affair can be assessed and understood only in terms of communist strategies, communist liberalization, and Western disarmament, and its implications for the West. 6. The author is more inclined to agree with the views of the Israeli and West German services, as expressed in a December 17, 1982, New York Times article written by Henry Kamm, in which he states that implicating the KGB in the assassination affair is outright disinformation. The author, however, does not agree with the article as to the purpose of such disinformation. In his opinion, the purpose was not to undermine or discredit Andropov, but to confuse the strategic implications. 7. There is also a serious contradiction in the actions of the Polish and Soviet governments regarding this affair. If the Soviet government perceives the Pope as an anti-communist involved in subversive activities against Poland and other communist countries, as implied in a TASS statement, it is incongruous that the Polish government would invite the Pope to visit Poland in June of 1983, since all such matters are coordinated with the Soviets. Another relevant comment probably should be added here. In view of the ardent public statements of some Italian socialist ministers regarding their acceptance of the communist involvement in this affair, such a position strengthens their vulnerability to an erroneous response to future Polish developments. Despite their genuine anti-communism, they would be pressured to accept the Polish liberalization as spontaneous.